stories don't define you. How you tell them will. Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins, your host and chief story maker of Elkins Consulting.
When we share stories, whether in our personal or business lives, how we share them makes a difference in how we remember them and in how we're perceived by the people we're sharing them with. When you're listening to this podcast, I encourage you to listen and consider your own related stories. To listen and think about which stories in your life might have impacted you in a similar way. And think about how you share those stories and the messages they carry for you and for the people who are hearing them.
I'm so happy to be recording an interview with another old friend from LinkedIn. I've been kind of reaching back to the people that I met early on LinkedIn, like 2013, 2014, 2015. And I realized that I hadn't interviewed any of those people that I met early on. And Mario McCracken was one of those people that I connected with very early on and just loved his writing. It was really warm and generous in terms of emotion and inspiration. And so I'm just so grateful that you agreed to be on the podcast. Thanks, Mario.
Oh, that was awesome. It's incredible to be talking with you. And yeah, it's been a great journey for sure. Excited to have this podcast, to be on it with you.
Yeah. Well, so my first question, and you probably get this all the time, Mario McCracken. I mean, it sounds like this mishmash of Italian and Scottish or Irish. Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about that? Because I'm sure our listeners will be curious.
Yeah. So my name Mario is spelled with an E, and my mother pronounces it Mario, and it's not really a real name. She did her PhD in ancient German literature. That's what she focused on because she's from Germany. She's a native of Germany and then came to the States when she was in college. And so she was studying ancient German literature and she was doing some research in some towns in southern Germany, kind of close to Italy around 500 years AD. That's kind of when these documents were found, right? During the Dark Ages. So there's not that many documents available from that time period because that's why it was called the Dark Ages. There wasn't very much that was recorded or kept or saved. But she kept coming across this word that she thinks through her translation efforts and through her studies means victory after battle, but she's not 100% sure. But that's the only time it made sense in that context was that word. So she thinks it has something, maybe a Latin influence, maybe some other influence in southern Germany. But that's kind of where she decided that she liked that name and she was going to name me that. And so yeah, it's not really a real name, and it's not really Italian. It's not really Spanish. It's Mareo, and it's just a name that she found doing some research.
Mareo.
Yeah, but she's the only one that calls me that.
Oh, everybody else says Mario?
Yeah, even my brothers and sisters. So nobody, yeah. She's the only one that says Mareo, yeah. Oh,
that is such a relief, because I hate to be wrong about how to pronounce somebody's name that I've known for this long.
No, that's all right.
That'd be a little embarrassing. Wow, Mareo. Mario McCracken. So McCracken, your family name, where does that come from?
Scotland. Scotland. So in 1750, a guy by the name of David McCracken washed up on the American shores and he ended up settling in North Carolina near where Asheville is currently today. And so McCrackens have lived in that same part of the country since 1750. 1754 actually is when like he finally made it to North Carolina, I think. But so, wow. And my grandfather still lives on the same land that they've been in the family for a few hundred years.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Well, that may just answer my next question that I always ask, but you may come up with something completely different. I always ask my guests to share something about themselves that most people not know about them. And the reason I do that is I like to build some context into the relationship between the guest and my audience. So what do you think? Do you have something else you could share other than the fact that Mareo is a made-up name?
So I was a manny in college, a male nanny. That was probably the best job I've ever had, actually, still to this day.
Oh, my gosh. Where were you in college?
I went to BYU in Utah.
So what made you decide to do that? Was it just an opportunity that landed in your lap, or is it something that you had thought about before?
Yeah, it was a unique situation. My sister actually texted me in the middle of Chinese class saying, my little sister, we're both at the same university. She said, hey, fax your, so this is how old it was. They asked for a faxed resume, right? they sent an email, of course, but for some reason they wanted a faxed resume. They said, fax your resume to this number. And she didn't even tell me what it was for. She said, you'd be awesome at this. Just fax your resume. So I faxed my resume. I walk into this doctor's office when they called me back and said, hey, come to this dental practice. And there was a whole bunch of other people in this dental office that weren't there to get their teeth done. And this family had 14 kids. They were an amazing family. And 8 of them were adopted of the 14. And the 3 youngest need a little more guidance and supervision than the parents who are now getting a little older could give at the time. So they wanted to hire someone to kind of be their tutor, be their mentor, pick them up after school, coach their basketball team, go to church with them on Sundays. It was just kind of like an all around awesome opportunity. And so I got paid $8 an hour and one meal a day at least. And I worked 40 hours a week all through college. And it was an amazing job.
Wow. And did you stay in their home then?
Often I did. Maybe 2-3 times a month. I'd stay overnight.
Wow.
But most of the time I didn't. They'd come with me. Like if I was going to a football game or basketball game while in college, they'd come with me. I'd go to the movies and my ticket was comped because I was taking their kids to the movies, right? So it's just a great job. And I still keep in touch with those 3 boys. They're pretty incredible young men. So
how old were they at the time?
13, 15, and 16 when I started.
Oh, no wonder. I was imagining little kids and I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. But they weren't that much younger than you were.
No, so not too much. I was 21 and a half when I started. Yeah.
Yeah. So the parents really were just mostly looking for somebody that could be their role model, like an older brother almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And because they had a bunch of older brothers, but they had left the home and it was just, right, you know, different situations. When you come from an adopted background, there's often a reason why, right? And so there's just lots of situations, right, that variables that played into that situation that made it difficult. And so we got to know each other really well and spent a lot of time together. And it was,
wow,
an incredible opportunity for sure.
Yeah. In Helena, Montana, there's actually the preeminent facility for children that struggle with attachment disorder. It's called the Intermountain Children's Home. And kids from all over the country come here to be residents there and address some of the attachment disorder, learn the tools and strategies to, first of all, recognize when you're suffering. You know, a lot of times they don't know where it's coming from. And this helps them identify which feelings are associated with that attachment disorder.
Then
certain tools that they can start to use to take care of that. And they work with whole families. And so that just really speaks to my heart. I've learned so much about it in the last 20 years of living here in this town. And they serve the whole community as well. It's not just residential. They also have facilities for locals to go in and seek treatment and counseling.
Awesome. Sounds like a great organization for sure.
It is. It absolutely is. And the people who work there are completely devoted to it and to the kids. And I don't think you can work in a place like that without having that personal mission to improve things for people and be
for
connected.
Sure.
Wow. So now I'm kind of in this place trying to think of where to take the interview in relation to that, because I think it's a really important aspect of your young adulthood.
It is for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me when they must have graduated from high school and then you were kind of done with that?
No, I only was with them for 2 years because I only spent 2.5 years on campus to get my first degree. Right. So I was with them for 2 years. And so the oldest was just about to enter his senior year when I graduated college. So he was 16 and then 18. So he just turned 18 and just started his senior year kind of when I finished up at my bachelor's degree.
So I can see that you have a really strong emotional connection to that time in your life, and particularly the boys.
Yeah.
When that youngest one was starting a senior year and you're getting ready to leave, was there a moment where you knew he was going to be okay? Was there one of those? Because I know you probably had some tough times trying to explain why certain behaviors weren't going to work for him and where he might get in his own way.
Yeah, I think so. They were, deep down, they were all really good boys. They wanted to be good and they were good already. And their parents were very strong and their parents had taught them the ways of honesty and they just taught them the right principles of life, right? And so they knew all those things. I think they just needed somebody that wasn't almost feeling like their grandparents, just spending more time with them, right? And so I don't think there was a single moment, no, but it was more throughout over the course, the more we got to trust each other and the more we communicated, you could tell they were more open and honest as the time went on. The first few months were harder, right? And then as time went on, we were just very honest. And when someone's honest with you, then you kind of know you can solve anything. So, and we just became very close. And I think over time, they just realized, you know, you don't have to do negative things to get attention and to feel validated. You can do positive things to get validated and feel attention in just a much more uplifting way than you would if you had to do something negative to get that attention.
Do you think that a big part of that trust to be vulnerable has to come, or honesty is the word you use. A big part of that honesty is knowing how you're feeling, being able to express how you're feeling in the first place. Because I think a lot of times, if we're not honest with ourselves about where we are and why we're feeling some way, or not knowing why we're feeling some way, but being able to express that we're feeling some way, it makes it really harder to be honest with the people that are trying to help us. Did you notice anything like that?
Yeah, I think you can go that direction. I think it's at least for teenagers, it was a lot more simple than that. And adults, we get in our heads a lot more and we start thinking about these things on a complex level, and we can name one emotion, can have 20 different names for it. Whereas, at least from my experience, being an older brother and now being a parent, it was you're mad or you're angry or you're sad or you're happy, right? There's like 5-6 emotions that you really focus on, and there might be variations within it, but as long as you can accept what you're feeling, then yeah, it's much easier for sure. But the variance of having 200 names for an emotion like we do now, as adults, how we try to label everything, it's good and it helps us get through things. But I think the reason people are able to be open and honest with you is if you're open and honest with them, they feel, oh, he's not trying to hide anything, or she's not trying to put on a show for me. She's actually who she is. He is who he is. So mm-hmm. that means I can be who I am to them. And I think that's kind of where it comes from.
Regardless of what the honesty is about.
Yeah. The honesty comes as a byproduct from trust, I think. And the trust is proven over and over in time with when you have intent, the right intent, right? Because most people that in a school situation, teachers have to pretend they're almost perfect because they have to know the answer. They have to tell the kids what to do, what they're doing is wrong. Whereas in the relationship I had with these boys, I didn't have to tell them I was perfect. They saw me living my life. They saw me making mistakes. I spent a lot of time with them and they could see that I was just a normal person. But so when I told them something, I didn't have to say, hey, I'm right and you're wrong. It was more, hey, this is probably not a good idea because of this and this. So it was a little different relationship for sure.
Yeah. I love the way you describe it as just being, not being grandparents hanging out and spending more time with them because their parents were old enough that the kids probably thought that they couldn't relate to them. Yeah, and you know, what's interesting about that concept too, is that it doesn't seem to matter what generation you're talking about. Younger generation will always think that the older generation doesn't understand them and can't relate to them.
Yeah.
And it's kind of ironic because we were there. It is, you know, there's a lot of overlap between what I felt at 12 and what another person now is feeling at 12 years old.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
I think we get so, like you said, we get so in our heads, we forget, especially as a young person, that this has happened over and over again. There's nothing new that's happening. Yeah. It's unusual now, but it's still, I mean, we're all dealing with similar things just at different age ranges. But
yeah.
So now, because you mentioned that it had a big impact on your life, when you think back now, what do you think was a pivotal time in that time that has continued to impact how you see yourself or how you see your role in relationships?
Well, it reinforced something I went through as a kid myself, and that's the labeling theory. So I didn't know what it was called until I studied sociology in college, and that was actually a sociological theory that you have to study, and we spent 2 full weeks in one class on just the labeling theory alone. And it's basically people live up to their labels, and so that's why labeling someone a felon produces more crime when you give them the title of felon, because now they have to live up to that label. But labels are super powerful. And I first learned it with from my mother when I was a boy. She always called me my whole life her little peacemaker. So we had six kids in my family, and obviously six kids in a 1,000-square-foot home, you're going to have fights, right? You're going to get on each other's nerves. You're going to get on top of each other when the boys are in one room, the girls are in another, right? And it's just this small enclosed place where there's lots and lots of activity. But she always called me her little peacemaker ever since I could remember, right? And so I lived that role. So whenever there was a fight or whenever something was bad was really happening, I would try to make peace. But when I think I was 15 or 16, when she finally told me of all her six kids, I was by far the worst for fighting when I was younger. I was by far the most likely to cause a problem and to start a fight. So when I was 4 or 5, she started labeling me as her peacemaker. That's just what she called me. And eventually I grew into that label and lived it and didn't even remember my previous self, right? And then that was the same with almost everybody that you come in contact with, even today in my professional career, but especially with these boys that I was fortunate to spend time with, is people will live up to their labels. So if you're kicked out of school and you're known as a troublemaker, you're going to keep doing that because that's who you are. That's who you become. Mm-hmm. And so if just giving people different labels and giving them the right encouragement can change a lot of things. And so that reinforced that message lesson I learned as a teenager from my mother. Then it reinforced it when I was in my early 20s. And then now as a professional, the labeling theory is, I still think, one of the most powerful things you can do as a leader is understand it and learn how to apply it.
That's really interesting. I think I'm going to have to read up on that again. It's been many years, probably since college in the early 90s, that I read that. So I'm going to have to follow up on that. It's really fascinating, the labeling theory. I agree. Labeling can be such a double-edged sword. And one of the things, because I say this a lot, I get really aggravated with generalizations. When people generalize, you lump all of some type of person or all of some population in one way, and that only leads to problems.
For
because
sure.
it becomes an us and them.
Yes.
However, there is a time when it's a useful tool. Like when you're creating a model around a community, you have to generalize to create anything that's going to be meaningful at all, because each individual can't be added to the map. It just, yeah. Especially in a 300 million people country, it's just impossible. But one of the things that I've learned, thanks to Kate McLean out of Eastern Washington University, is what you're saying about your mom calling you the peacemaker is interesting, because her research and the research of her colleagues is that the stories that people tell about you, around you, help to create your identity,
yeah.
Positive or negative. And this starts happening before you even have words. So before you're even two, if your mother was calling you back then, even though she didn't know that she was going to have to, you know, trick you into being, yes, a peacemaker, but if she had even, as soon as you were born, started, or not as soon as you're born, but as soon as you could walk or move, and she would say, "You were always my peacemaker. This one time you did A, B, and C." Then you would believe that story. And again, just like labeling theory, you would live up to it. And while a specific label is powerful, I think the stories resonate even more deeply because there's an action involved in them and memory that gets created and shifted. It may not even be an accurate memory, but because of the way somebody tells that story, it becomes part of your identity. And she said the real danger is during that transition period. And this is why I'm bringing this up, is because you were at the beginning of the transition period for those young men. That transition period between 17 and 22-ish, I mean, obviously that's a generalization right there, but that transition from teen to young adult is particularly difficult when it comes to those stories creating your identity, because if your parents or the people around you, the people you respect and admire and spend time with, are telling stories that conflict with how you want to see yourself as an adult, as you're establishing your adult identity, if it conflicts, it can cause some serious issues and friction not just between you, which is normal to some extent, you know, you're going to have friction as that child establishes themselves as independent from parenthood, but it can also cause some real friction internally with a kid that's trying to establish themselves and then they kind of give up, like, oh no, my mom said this. My mom tells me this story, and so this must be who I am. And they kind of, I guess they, you would call it a failure to thrive, depending on what their vision is of themselves.
That's, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So I love how this is all coming together. It's all such complementary information. So as you think about that and that the labeling theory, what you're doing as an adult and you're performing in your work, where have you really seen that the labeling theory in action in a specific incident with colleagues or?
Anytime someone has to go into a new role that they don't think they're good enough for, it used to be, and maybe I don't want to let the cat out of the bag, so hopefully nobody at work listens to this, my current company. But the idea is, if you want someone to do a good job in their new role, you tell them you believe that they can do a good job because you noticed that they have these skills that will lead to that. So you have to be honest, but you don't really know if someone's going to be good in a new role. You think they're going to be good. You hope they're going to be good, but you don't really know. But you label them as, hey, you're going to be the perfect fit for this. So this promotion is going to be really good for you. And I think you can really help the company and help yourself and grow your career. So it's all honest, but at the same time, you're assigning a label that doesn't actually exist yet because they've never done that. And so that's one place I've seen it be very powerful is when, give someone the confidence they need based on their previous work, but you still are throwing a dart in the air, right? And usually it's turned out to be positive more times than negative. So I kind of still believe in it.
Yeah, I would say most of the time that would work unless you have somebody who's really arrogant. And then that could backfire a little bit. I'm thinking of somebody in particular that I used to work with that would have backfired. Then they would have thought that they could just not hard because, oh, he already thinks I'm going to be good. So I'm good. I'm golden.
Wow,
but
yeah.
There's a vision in my head right now of that particular person. And that's not somebody I would ever want to work with again. Yeah. But can you think of a specific example of a colleague that worked with maybe at your previous position?
Yeah, for sure. I have a few exact examples. It's somebody I'm working with right now. He is very talented, very smart, very bright, and he was in a very technical role where he wasn't as suited for it because his natural personality is definitely to solve problems but he's very, very good at talking with people. Whereas most programmers and coders, they don't really want to talk to people or talk as little as possible, right? And so he was in that role where he wanted to be a coder because he thought of himself as a developer and a programmer, but his real talent was actually solving problems and talking to people and doing both simultaneously, right? So it wasn't just one or the other. He needed to do both to really shine. And so we put him in a new role and where he gets to use his technical skills, but focus on the people side of it and the actual application of it. And he's thriving and he's doing a great job. But yeah, we definitely had to help him see that he could transition because he always wanted to see himself as a coder because that was the story he was telling himself, was that he was a programmer, but that wasn't the best fit for him at the time. And now he's doing a lot better in his career and he's grown quite a bit and he's doing better in his career because of it.
Isn't that funny? I mean, and funny in kind of a sad way and funny in an exciting professional development way that, when you develop good relationships with your people, whether it's your boss or your employee that you're managing, when you develop a good enough relationship with somebody that you can see the magic in them, you can see what they are really good at, even if they don't see it. And then you can help them see themselves that way, especially in the situation where you have somebody that thinks they're one thing. And everyone around him is like, you're not very good at that. I mean, that's how you see yourself, but you could be so much better at something else. I mean, you can do this, but it's not your magic. It's not I get kind of sick of this phrase, your genius zone, but it's accurate. Everybody has one And I love that you and your team were able to see that in this person and build them up so they wouldn't feel like they were drowning in imposter syndrome when they started the new role.
Yeah. It was pretty, it was a pretty fun experience, and we still get to work together daily. So it's great.
Wow. So, I'm guessing that this is something that you've used to help battle imposter syndrome in some ways. Have you done it on yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Probably not as consciously as I do when I do for others, but yeah, anytime you're doing something new, you have to tell yourself you're going to do well or you're going to fail. It's kind of like in a sporting event, if you think you're going to miss the shot in basketball, you're going to miss the shot. Like, it's just, you have to tell yourself a better story. And it's not fake it till you make it. It's do it until you become it, which is very different than fake it till you make it. And so fake it till you make it is imposter. Do it till you become it is real life, just telling yourself the right story. And you get to choose the story, right? Like your whole book talks about, you get to choose how you define the story, or how you tell the story so its definition can change. And so, yeah, I think you have to do it or you're never going to try anything new.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's where that whole idea of visualizing and manifesting.
Yeah, that's probably part of it.
So I'm hearing now is the connection between manifesting or visualizing and labeling. And I this is off the top of my head, so I'm going to give you a chance to think about this. But yeah. I was just this morning talking to somebody about manifesting things in your life. And I can say that years ago, probably 7 or 8 years ago, I started imagining myself doing more keynote speaking because I loved performance and trainings. And so I started actually imagining myself on stages and what would I wear and what would I talk about and what kind of branding would I put on my slides if I was going to use slides and would I sing, would I involve music in my keynotes. And so I started really thinking a lot about what it would look like. And I guess in some sense, that is kind of a form of labeling. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, that actually, the way you described it and the way it's coming together, yeah, 100%. Yeah. It's just taking labeling instead of for other people, how it's usually considered is you put it to yourself and you do it in a lot more. It's like labeling on steroids, right? Because you're visualizing it. So yeah, visualization is super powerful. And visualization is assigning future labels to yourself. So yeah, I think that's really good. I like that.
Huh. So can you describe the labeling theory just a little so we back up a little, and then I'll include a link to a description either from the dictionary or Psychology Today.
From what I remember from my 2004 sociology, I think it's called Social Psychology 350 from Dr. Bert Burriston. But I think the basic definition is people in general live up to their labels.
Okay. Yep, that totally makes sense. I seem to remember that from human development course as well. But that was even before 2004. That would have been in 1990 or 91. Yeah. I was one of those people that had far too many interests, and so I changed majors 4 times. But as a result, I got a full breadth of liberal arts education. I did. I definitely wasn't focused in one area. So I'm really kind of loving this direction that we're taking on labeling and how that works externally. And of course, there's the opposite. You're a troublemaker and you're going to be a troublemaker. And then the person can take responsibility, make a conscious decision not to fit that identity anymore. Yeah. Have you seen that happen where... So my first example that just popped into my head is my friend Tom Dietzler that you might also know on LinkedIn.
Yeah,
he told Wisconsin, Appleton, Wisconsin.
Oh, Wisconsin, sorry.
Yeah, Aaron Scogan is Minnesota, which you know, all part of that same crew of awesome Midwestern, lovely, loving people. Anyway, so Tom told me a story when I was interviewing him about when he was 16 and he was hanging out with those kids that were known as the troublemakers. And he wasn't a particularly bad troublemaker, but he was spending time with those kids. And the way they teased each other was how they kind of connected. And it was pretty negative stuff, but that was their friendship. It's how it showed up. Yeah. And he made this conscious decision. He saw where their lives were headed. He saw their older brothers. He saw their dads. And he was, I don't want to go there. That is not the life I envisioned for myself. And he did a 180 and went back to one of his childhood friends that he had known when he was, you know, in his preteen years, and said, I want to hang out with people who are going to go do something more interesting with their lives. And that's the path I want to follow. Can you help me? Can I hang out with you again? And the kid was like, yeah, of course. And then he talks about how he kind of had to audition. That's how he felt when he was being included in their group for the first few times they hung out. He felt kind of like he was auditioning. But he made that conscious decision. And it took a while. He lived in a small town, and so lots of people didn't necessarily believe it. So do you have another example of that where somebody independently decided?
That's a lot of self-awareness from Tom, for sure. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I
hearing that story just totally got me going.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I think we all go through different stories like that where we see someone and we say, hey, I don't want to be that person. Whether it's conscious or not, determines on how far down the path we are. Like Tom sounded like he was on the path already. He didn't just see someone doing something. He was part of that group for a while and he knew he had to get out. So that's even harder, right? Once you're part of it, to get out is really hard. But yeah, so my father didn't make the best choices. So my mom raised all six of us by herself. When I was six is when my father stopped being in the picture anymore. And so there were six kids my mom raised.
And you had two younger siblings, right?
I had four younger. I was the second oldest.
Four. Oh, okay.
My mom was still pregnant with the youngest. So not everybody makes the best choices, right? And so I learned what type of father I was going to be from the exact opposite of what I saw. And that's kind of where I made that internal commitment, right? But then I had friends, fathers, who were super amazing fathers. And I said, I want to be like Cameron's dad, or I want to be like Steve's dad, right? And so that's kind of, you have the juxtaposition of you see your environment, but like Tom, he saw another environment and you can pick and choose. And so sometimes it's harder to pick and choose when you feel like there's no other option though. So if you don't have other options to see, then it's really hard to make good choices or better choices. But if you have various options, you can pick and choose.
And did you see your brothers also make a conscious decision or?
For sure. Well, I don't know if they made a conscious decision. I think it was who we were and how we were raised. Yeah, my little brother has three kids and his wife's pregnant with their fourth. And yeah, and then I have three little sisters and they all have, they're all doing great too as moms. And so,
As far as labeling goes, that is often the label that we pick up is I'm going to be just like my dad. And even if it's a negative thing, oh, I'm making these bad choices, so I must be just like my dad. I kind of went through that in my late 30s when I noticed that I was having similar career issues to what my dad had had. And he really struggled because he was brilliant. I mean, hands down brilliant. But he had no sense of how to present his brilliance to people, particularly his bosses.
Okay.
And so he consistently would piss them off by being smarter than they were. And, and not intentionally saying I'm smarter than you are, but he would make decisions or they would say something. He'd be like, well, that's not a good idea. And he didn't present it in a way that was kissing ass. He just wouldn't do it. Yeah. It wasn't his thing. And so he got fired more than once. When there were layoffs, he would, you know, they'd have an excuse to let him go because he was arrogant. And, and I've never struggled with arrogance. That has never been a problem for me. But there have been times, and I found this out through StrengthsFinder, I have command in my top strengths. And so there are times when I do come across as bossy and kind of a know-it-all. And I only share information that I know. Yeah. So it's not about everything, but definitely I could see, especially back in my late 30s and early 40s, how that would come across badly. But my struggle was, I'm just like my dad. That was the label I'd given myself.
Wow. Yeah, that's a tough one for sure. But you seem to found a way to express yourself better now, right?
Yes. Thank goodness. But there's a reason I'm self-employed. No, I think that your point is really, really important, that you made the decision based on the models you saw about who you were going to be. And there may have been external factors where people would have given you negative labels, but it sounds to me like you had decided what your labels were going to be, and they were positive labels. Did you ever fight a negative label that you either heard from someone else or you had given yourself?
Yeah, you have to fight negative labels all the time. I think the kids, you know, little kids fight, right? So I think my sisters knew that the worst thing they could ever say to me is, hey, you're going to be just like dad, if I was doing something mean, right? So anytime I didn't do something right, and that would be a label like, oh yeah, I better stop. And so that always halted me in my tracks, because they knew where to cut, right? Because we have a great relationship, but when you get to know someone so well, you know exactly what to say. And yeah, that was a negative label, right? That you didn't want to live up to, right?
That is a big one. And I love that they got it. I hope they used it in sparingly.
Oh yeah, it was more than a couple of times my whole life. Yeah. Like that's the end all be all. That's the coming. Yeah.
I know. Like when I do something wrong, my dad didn't have to punish me. He didn't have to ground me. All he had to do was say, "I'm just so disappointed." And that was more than enough punishment for me. Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. Well, let's come full circle as we wrap up. And I'd love to hear a story about a pivotal time in your life where you, and this may relate to the labeling theory, or it may relate more to your interactions with those young men. A time in your life where you realized you were in exactly the right place doing exactly the right thing, where you walked away thinking, nailed it.
Oh, man. Yeah, those are the best, right? And then writing those down and then remembering those are super important too, so you can go back to them in times when you're not, right? Mm-hmm. So I love helping people make good decisions. That's what I think I've realized is what I do the best at. And so how you express that can be lots of ways. You can do it with conversations. You can do it with speaking. You can do it with writing. You can do it with sales. So the time when I noticed I wasn't in the right place is when I was selling the wrong thing, that I didn't think if that person would buy it or that company would purchase it, that they were making the best decision for them. And so then that was when I was in inner conflict, right? So I'm like,
yeah, there's no alignment there.
I realized that, though, that's why I had so much conflict. One time I was working for a company and I was living in London, and it was going to be the most incredible experience. My wife and I, we just gotten married, no kids. We got put as expats in London. Everything was going to be perfect, making better income than I should have. And I just never could feel right about what I was doing. And I didn't know why. And I just never connected. It took me years to figure out that I had to get out. But then now when I look at my current role, my full-time job, I spend at least half my time helping people make good decisions in some way or another. So yeah, I put up with the Excel spreadsheets and I put up with all the boring stuff that I'm not good at, because I have to do it to get the job done. Because you always have to do stuff that maybe isn't what you're skilled at, or you're best at, but you're competent enough to do it. But when you really are doing something that you really feel empowered to do, and that you can make a good, that you can really help people, then that's, and so even right now in my current job, I really feel that way, where I help people make good decisions, whether that's the two owners of the company that I work for, helping them make better decisions, or the team I lead, or customers in a sales role, because most of my focus is sales and marketing. And I'm just helping people make better decisions than they would have if I wasn't there. And so that's kind of how you justify all the work. And so, yeah.
So I'm imagining when you had to present this new role for a guy who saw himself as a programmer.
Yeah.
How did you help him make the decision? Because he not only had to agree to it, he had to decide that he could live up to the labels that you were giving him. So how did that conversation go?
Well, it depends on the personality, right? For with someone, sometimes you can be really hype and you can get really excited and be really emotional. Other times you have to be very logical and present the facts. And this, we had to, with this exact situation, we had to be a mix. Because he was technical, he needed to be shown the facts. He needed to be shown, hey, for career progression, you have this much career growth with this job. With this, you have a flexibility to do this and this. And so you laid out the options and you laid out the facts, but then you say, but then you had to bring in the passion and the enthusiasm later. And so it was really saying, hey, you're going to do great at whatever you do, but if you want to do really good, then you should probably do something that you're better suited for. And you might think you're suited for this, but from watching you and working with you the past year, I really feel that you could do a great job at this. And, so, and then they can make a decision on their own. You still don't force them, but you highly encourage.
It sounds like you were asking questions to help him guide himself while at the same time describing to him what you knew to be true about him from your experience with him.
Yeah, true. You always have to ask questions. If you don't ask somebody questions, you can't really get to know what they're thinking, or you don't want to tell them all the answers either. You have to ask questions and they have to tell themselves the answers. And so you don't want to give them everything, right? Because yeah, they want to, everybody feels better when they came to the conclusion on their own. That's in every relationship in life.
So when you walked away from that conversation, did he make the decision during that time or did he ask for more time? Is he one of those people because he's technical that he needed to think about it?
He had to think about it for sure. Mm-hmm. He says, wow, yeah, sounds promising. Let me look into it. Cause he never thought about it. Right. But he was positive. It wasn't like, no, I'm not going to do it. It was more, yeah, let me think about it.
He had to wrap his head around this whole new vision of
it. It actually took 2 months. It wasn't like a quick thing either.
2 months.
Yeah, but it took 2 months. But we had the flexibility to make it work because the position we were opening was being created from scratch. It wasn't like he was replacing something we needed done right then. We were starting something new anyway. So it worked.
Wow.
And if we had pressure, maybe we would have. But since we knew we had the time, we were able to just have continue. We probably talked about it once or twice a week for the next 2 months until it was official.
So now I'm just so curious. What was the first time that he did something or said something or his meeting or whatever, where you walked away going, yes, we were right. This is exactly where he's supposed to be. Cause that's part of your love of and motivation to help people make decisions is seeing how it comes out for them afterward when they've done the right thing.
He does it all the time, but one of the first ones was, so we do demos of complex enterprise software for big, huge, massive billion-dollar companies. And so usually I'm involved in the demos, but one of the demos I couldn't be involved in. So he had to take over and he had just kind of started maybe into his new job for a few weeks. And we didn't know how it was going to turn out, right? He had to do it by himself basically. But we had faith that he could do a good job. But then after we talked to him, he said he thinks it went all right. But then I called the potential client and they were really impressed. And so that's when it was validation that, yes, he did a good job because he could and because he worked hard and he did the right thing. And it was validated by an outside source. So it was pretty good. Mm-hmm.
So it validates your belief, your label about yourself also.
For
and
sure.
As much as it's about him, it's also about the fact that that's part of you. That's your what or your how is helping people make good decisions because you know decisions like that can impact the rest of their lives as well as all the people around them, the success of the organization itself. So I love that you were able to not just validate for him, but also validate for yourself that you were on the right track. You had good instincts about the guy and you helped guide him to make the right choice. And I love that. If only there were more mentors and bosses and colleagues that were that thoughtful and cared enough to really see what somebody's good at. Because, you know, the other option, if you hadn't been like that, if you and your team hadn't been like that, would be to let him go because he wasn't performing to expectations in the previous role.
Yeah.
That would have been
the easy time. Yeah,
that's the easy answer. But for you to say, wait a minute, I really like this person. He has a lot to offer. What is he really, really good at? If it's not that, and that's just the thing that just drives me crazy about the environment that I've experienced so much in my life and that I keep hearing about is that lack of understanding that people are so complex, and that when you find somebody that's loyal and that works hard, even at something they're not good at, they keep on working at it and they're resilient and persistent. Why would you let that go? Like, that is just find what they can bring to the table, because clearly leaving that behind is just kind of a, my dad would say, it's spiteful. It's like cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Yeah, exactly. And you see it all too much, because lots of people think it's too much effort to retrain someone or to individually coach someone, right? There's all those. Yeah, it's baffling to me to think that you'd let people who are hardworking and persistent and resilient go. I just don't. Yeah.
That's crazy. Well, and that's a good place to wrap up, because I don't want to go down that path. I'll find myself getting all anxious and angry again. And the whole reason I went into what I do with coaching and coaching teams, or whatever communication coaching that I'm doing with whatever team, is because I'm so committed to helping people like their jobs again. And the only way to do that is to work with management leaders to say, your team isn't going to like what they're doing if you are not coaching them to their strengths, if you're not helping them through clear communication, if you're not valuing them. So there's always the responsibility from the employee, but you're a lot more likely to have that positive response from your employee when the manager is coaching them to their strengths and recognizing them. So, and you know all of that, especially in all your writing.
I'm learning.
Well, hopefully that never ends, that whole learning thing. But from all of the reading that I've done of your writing, you totally get that. You practice what you preach, you walk the walk, and that's part of why I'm so grateful for our friendship.
That's awesome. Yeah, thank you.
So, Moreo, I'm going to call you that from now on. No, I'm not. if our listeners want to get in touch with you, I will add these links to the blog post associated with this podcast on my website, elkinsconsulting.com. But if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do it? And what would you, if you could give them anything of your materials, your content to read, what would that be?
Oh, content to read. I'm not sure, but contact me, Mario McCracken. I'm the only one in the world with that spelling of the first and last name together. So it's not hard to find. Mario McCracken. But one piece of advice is listen to the people who love you and want what's best for you. I started writing because I was reading about a book a week, 2013, 2012, and my wife said, how come you read so much but you don't share what you're learning with anybody? I'm like, well, I'm learning so I can do better in my job and better in my career and be better for my team. She's like, why don't you just write about what you're learning and then share it with a lot more people? And so I started doing it almost reluctantly at first, but because I started doing it, it transformed into something that I actually really love doing. And it was because I listened to someone who also loved me and cared about me. Because people can love you but not care about you. And people can care about you and not necessarily love you, and for different reasons, right? But if someone loves you and cares about you, listen to them. And that's, I think, the most important thing to remember.
I love that. And what she was not saying that you also know, and I just saw an interaction between you and Kimberly Davis, is that when you write these things down, it helps solidify the concepts in your own head. So
sure.
You're writing it for yourself as much as you're writing it to share.
Yeah.
So
100%.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I appreciate that very much. So Mario McCracken, I will have a link to connect with Mario. I was just going to say Moreo again. On LinkedIn, I'll have a connect link on there so that you can reach out to him. And I highly encourage you to do so. All of the things that Mario shares are solid content and all kinds of amazing book recommendations. When you're reading at least 4 books a month, you can absorb a lot of interesting information and share it. So thank you so much for joining me today.
All right. Thanks, Sarah. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. If you're planning an event or company retreat and want to bring in a memorable, entertaining, and highly practical speaker as your keynote speaker or workshop facilitator, please visit us at elkinsconsulting.com to learn how we can help and provide a memorable keynote or breakout session. Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you.